Welcome to the Ad Tech Marketing Podcast, the only podcast devoted to the very niche topic of ad tech marketing. I am joined today by someone who also inhabits that niche, or at least an adjacent one, Adam Ryan, the CEO and co-founder of Workweek. How's it going, Adam?
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me on, and glad our Twitter of co-follows and co-likes is now bringing us to this podcast.
Adam, you are one of the other five people on the internet who talks about B2B social and marketing and whatnot. And I often just read your posts on Twitter and I'm like, yes, that is exactly it. That is the thing I was going to post today. So this was inevitable.
I'm glad we can talk circles around each other and hopefully this one amplifies the message a little bit further.
So one of the conceits of this pod, which of course, as a millennial entrepreneur and a man who formerly lived in Brooklyn, I have multiple podcasts. And one of the conceits of this one in particular was that like human content is going to be more valuable than ever. And actually over the weekend, I was listening to the Howard Schultz episode of Acquired, or re-listening to it. You know, Acquired, they usually don't have the entrepreneur on, but in this case, he came on, they spoke for over 3 hours about Starbucks. And I'm listening to this thing and I'm like, you know, I listened to this once before and it made such a big impression on me. Why am I so into it? I was listening for like the business lessons that make it so valuable. And then I realized like an hour three, I was like, oh no, it's obviously not the business lessons. Like anyone can share these lessons. It's that like, I feel Howard Schultz's like soul, you know, when I listen to this, like I hear his journey and how he grew up and like where he is. And so I've been thinking a lot more about that in the pod. And that brings me to my first question, which is I wanted to know for you, when you think back to like how you grew up in the long path leading to ultimately becoming an entrepreneur, what do you see sort of in your like early life that you could draw a connected line from there to now?
Howard Schultz is also my favorite CEO ever. So what an opening for me. Everyone in our office will be like, you intertwined Starbucks. This podcast was meant for you. There's so many things that I think with reflection in the moment, you don't know, right? You're going through so many things. I was a terrible student and I have terrible ADHD, couldn't sit still in class, always wanted to be in competitive sports and did that. And there's so much of this kind of interesting aspect where like during the day, I always felt like I was failing. And then at 3 to 6, I was always like winning. And I feel like that's entrepreneurship to the T. Like I never felt like I was doing well in school, but then like I get accolades and our teams were winning and doing all these things. And it was this like way I had to almost like learn how to justify and also like recognize like, man, I can't win at all these things, but I'm kind of good at this thing. So let's like keep doubling down on what you're good at. And I think that's a part of it. Like most people, also the chip on the shoulder, learning how to go through bullying or divorced parent, like anything kind of adversarial that I had both of those things happen. And like that teaches you how to just kind of like go with the punches. And then when I got to college, I was walking past the business school for the summer welcome and my mom was a nurse but she didn't go to a 4-year traditional college and she just went to nursing school. And we were walking past the business school and she's like, Adam, what do they do with business degrees? And I was like, Mom, I have no idea. And she's like, well, what do you want to do? And my uncle was a football coach and teacher. And I was like, I guess I'm going to become a teacher. And that whole kind of like journey, I think is like, you only can deal with the cards that you're dealt, but also you just have to be curious. And I went from teaching to getting a marketing internship with a Procter & Gamble. And I was like, wow, this is way more fun than teaching ninth graders about the judicial system. And that kind of kept it going until finally my senior year, I started finding different things that I really found passionate about and then started to pursue those more.
So you mentioned that when you were a kid, you actually weren't natural academically in school. A lot of entrepreneurs have that experience. Mine was actually very different, which I'll get into eventually. But did you have the thing that like some kids who aren't academically inclined have where you're like, oh no, like, am I dumb? And then you're like, you know, or were you kind of like, oh, this isn't my thing, but I feel like I'm smart. I just don't like this setting. Like how'd that evolve for you?
You know, I have to give my parents like tons of credit. I definitely felt my middle school separated us out into three tracks. There was basically like what would be in layer like AP honors and then everyone else. And then like remedial, like with like, there was like 10 of us and I was in remedial. And I remember like looking around being like, I don't think I belong in this group of people. But like after a while, you're kind of like told that at school, you believe it. But my parents never let me believe that I was dumb. They didn't believe that I was dumb. They always believed I had a hard time following through on things and all the other conditions that happen with when you have terrible ADHD. But I never believed in my like soul that I was dumb. And I saw it like in spurts. Like I always had I was always really good at math. I had this like passion for history and like learning things and tinkering and building stuff. And so I started writing a newsletter when I was like in seventh grade that was physical, like an actual news thing. And I just like always had stuff that didn't make me feel stupid. And I think that was like my protection of my parents really helped me do that. But yeah, I mean, I remember I was in student government in high school and we were the only ones that were allowed to know the rankings of our class because we gave out Student of the Year awards. And I was like 252 out of 270. And everyone else in the whole student government was like top like 15. And I was like, am I like that dumb? Like what? And you know, and I was, but it was this thing where I also like learned it's like the room that you're in, both like in how you see yourself, but also like how you can build confidence. And I think that was, it was definitely something I battled for a long time. And then I later kind of learned that like, you just had to check the box and go through life of sometimes like, hey, in order for people not to think you're dumb, like, go get a master's degree. So that's what I did. I was like, I was terrible in school, but I'm going to get a master's degree so no one ever thinks I'm dumb. And like, that's just sometimes the things that you have to do in life. And I think I learned that through my struggles in school.
And then what was it like when you got into sports and you mentioned you had more of a natural aptitude there and you sort of fit into the structure? Were you super competitive? Like, did you love winning?
Absolutely competitive. I have a story where my sophomore year of high school, I started showing up to work out in the morning at school. Our varsity football coach would get there at like 6:30 in the morning. So I started getting there at 6:30 in the morning and he didn't like to be beat. So then he got there at like 6:25. And then I got there at like 6:20. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was at my school at 5 a.m. and he was there by like 4:40, like impossibly early. And it was just like this like innate thing of like, yeah, I can do that. I'll play that game. Let's go. And also like, I want to win. And I think it also with school, I learned like, no matter how hard I tried, I was going to suck on a test. I just believed it. I just like thought that I couldn't sit down for 2 hours and take a test. But I learned in sports, like the harder you work, actually the more success you can have. And I think that helped a lot. One of the values at Workweek is like create competition everywhere. I think life's more fun when you're competing about things. And there's a reason why the 4-minute mile just kept getting broken and broken. Like, I think human nature is to look at people to your left and right and try to beat them.
I totally agree. I love competitiveness as a value. So it's funny, like there are a lot of similarities in our childhoods, but then the venue we found to exercise our competitive drive was different because I actually loved school. I was just like a huge nerd. It came really naturally to me. I was like, when I started to really love it was when we started competing at things because I was like, oh, we're going to see who can do the times tables the fastest. And I'm like, I'm going to do these times tables the fastest of everyone in the school. And you all are going to know that. And like, I'm taking the crown. We're going to fight over that. And that was basically my whole childhood was like exercising the same competitive drive, but in the classroom. But it's a very common story, right? It's very common that entrepreneurs didn't like find school natural or they didn't sort of fit into the academic box. And I think what's common to any entrepreneur's story is that you have a certain talent, you have a certain competitiveness that might manifest in school, sports, wherever, but you have to sort of go like outside the box. So I would say, for example, even you showing up at like 5 a.m., that's going outside the box, right? That's like, you could have just done like the normal, like varsity athlete thing or whatever, but you were like, I'm going to find sort of this other thing I can do that is not expected of me, where I like, I'm going to excel and sort of exercise my drive. And same thing with starting, you know, the newsletter when you were, I think you said seventh grade. So I have a lot of those things. For me, it was more in the academic arena, but it was like, you're telling me I can take 3 APs and like, I'm going to take 4. Right. Or like I'm doing this class, but like I'm going to like go find this other thing I can do that you didn't know like anyone in the school could do. So it's like we have that sort of experience of like we're not very good with authority generally. And we're like, I'm going to find this new place to pursue my passions.
Well, that was probably the best lesson I learned my sophomore year. I was taking a Spanish class and I was not going to pass. And I went to college preparatory high school. It was like unusual for how bad I was doing in school, and everyone was all concerned. And my parents were told basically, like, you have to get him a tutor. Like, you have to find him a tutor to help him learn Spanish. On the second lesson with this tutor, I will never forget this conversation. It changed basically my whole view of life. She looked at me and she was probably like 20 something years, like very young. She looked at me and she like looked around to make sure my parents couldn't hear. And she's like, I just need to tell you the truth. You are absolutely not going to pass this class. And like, there's no way that you're going to pass this class. And what you need to do is walk up to your teacher tomorrow and very politely be like, I recognize I'm not going to pass this class. What do I need to do to get a C? And then do exactly what they tell you to do. And I did that exact thing the next day. They were basically like, quit falling asleep in class, do these things, do this thing, and we'll see what happens at the end of the semester. And I did that, and I got a C that I did not deserve. And I think the other aspect of like failure is you learn this way out of it. And on the flip side of competitiveness, and you know, I kind of, that was my, I like to tell people that was like my first sales close of my life of like, huh, I guess I'll walk up to my teacher and basically say like, I need this thing. What can I do to get it done? You don't go through that when life comes easy at you, or if you're not competitive or going for the next thing. I think that's, it doesn't feel like a blessing at the time, but it definitely is.
Something in that story really touches me. And I think it's about like honesty, right? Like,
yeah.
There's something very cool about, I guess what I loved about school as a kid and what I now love about entrepreneurship is like, I've been thinking over this phrase, which is like, it tells you the truth in a way. Like, it's like, there's a scorecard, right? There's a report card. And so it's like, it's the hardest thing, but also the best thing about business is that like, I also did grad school. You mentioned doing a master's. Like I did a PhD in literature. And like, dude, that is so full of bullshit. It's just like, there's no objectivity. It's like everyone kind of knows like who's better at writing or whatever, but it's like, ultimately they just kind of pass you through and like some professors give you a hard time and some lavish praise on you. And it just like, it all feels like convoluted, like bullshit. And there's something about that story where it's just like someone having the honesty to like, and the accountability level with you and be like, I'm your tutor. My job is to help you pass this, but I just got to be honest, bro. It's not going to happen.
So and we kept meeting. Kept meeting. By the way, she kept collecting the check, and I was like, "All right, yeah, sure." I actually think though, like on the flip side of that too, I later became a teacher. So I got my undergrad in education. Is my after we walked past the business school, and I was like, "I don't know what to do." I was like, "Well, I know what you do with an education degree," and so I got my undergrad and then my master's in education, and I always thought there was this like faux relationship between student and teacher, like. You know, you see Miss Robinson in the grocery store, you're like amazed who she is, right? But like that exists in the classroom. And there's just like not this honesty of like, hey, I'm doing my best as a teacher. I need you to do your best. And like together, we're probably not going to actually show up the best every day. Like, but let's like try to make progress. And that like kind of value around, you get way more out of what you want when you tell the truth. It's way harder sometimes. And it's carried with me. I mean, and I think that's why, I did fall in love with advertising is I was like, wow, everyone lies in this industry. If you like tell the truth, you probably can get pretty far. And like, it was kind of the same pattern recognition I have with teaching where I was like, all of you teachers are just like subconsciously lying to your students about what you expect out of them. Like, be honest, they're 14. And there's a value of honesty that I think not only helps you sleep good at night and feels like you're a good person and doing the right thing in the world, but also that vulnerability like creates buy-in across the board and helps you kind of get further, I think.
Leveling with people, I agree, is something that is very rare in education. Like there's this sense that like students, it's like, okay, well, we're all aiming for A's, but it's like, again, I guess like, especially in public school or whatever, right? Like, or probably in any school, like teachers, they can't go to a kid and just be like, look, man, you're not going to get an A+ in this class, but like, mm-mm. Like now you're at first test, you're at a C. What we're going to see is, can we get you to a B or a B+, right? And it's like, that is, I know the mentality I try to bring to business is like with my team, it's like, if we're talking about a failure, and some people really struggle to understand this because they're used to this mentality of like sort of punishing failure and sort of the lack of honesty and whatever. I'm like, look, if we're talking about what went wrong in H1, right? We're talking, it's August. So like, let's say we're analyzing H1, we're looking at the data, we're getting the cold hard evidence as to what we did well and what we did wrong. If we're looking at what we did wrong, I'm really never coming from a place of like self-flagellation or like flagellating others, right? I'm really coming from a place of like, we did this. This was the results, right? Maybe we got a C on the test. All right, how do we get a B? And then how do we turn the B into an A? I mean, essentially what we're talking about is every workplace, if you look at the values, they all say they care about like accountability, right? Accountability is really effing hard. That's why like everyone says they care about it, because it's so important, but so elusive. But I think it's this ability to level with yourself that makes it possible. And I think that to level with yourself, you have to have this acceptance of like, we're on a long journey here. And we're like in, you know, stage 2, and we're trying to get to the end, stage 10. And like, we're just trying to improve from one stage to the next, because then you give yourself the permission to be honest about where you're at, which for most of us probably isn't anywhere near as good as we ultimately want to be.
And I think there's the other kind of aspect of entrepreneur business that I think school does like an awful job, and the education system does an awful job of, is it's like a natural apples to apples rubric, which then creates failures of like, or, you know, worse than better. And like, that is how the business world works. But the difference is like failure to the person who has dyslexia and all of a sudden gets a B in spelling is not failure. They're like, they did it. Or the person that never could finish a 6-hour test and like passes. And I think like it requires the kind of being an entrepreneur is this ability to like find competitiveness to the person to your left and right, but not to compare yourself, and recognize that failure is literally only what's in your own head. Rarely do you make a decision in your business that you're like, we're out of money. Like that's like that is failure. Failure is like, I didn't meet my own expectations. I didn't do the thing that I wanted to do. And I think school does a really bad job of that, where it doesn't, you actually like are reliant on extrinsic motivation versus intrinsic. And then when you get into business, you're like, if you're someone that like is only looking externally of like benchmarking, you're screwed, because like you don't know what path you're on and you're not listening then to yourself and your customers. And I think for people that, I think some of the reasons why people that struggled in school tend to do better is you have to learn to like be motivated by your own being and create your own goals versus being like, no, I'm not going to give an A in that class. It's never going to happen. But my teacher told me I can't fall asleep anymore and she'll give me a C. Like not falling asleep every day is a win. And I think that is a little bit of how I see entrepreneurship, is like, you have to wake up and just like want to be the best version of what you can possibly do. And then like occasionally be like, okay, this person on my left and right are doing that. I can do it too. But there's a difference of like creating these goals that just are, they're made up. They're not possible. And then you kind of like ruin the momentum and morale, I think, of your team. I think as anybody that's failed in school knows, like it's just such a demoralizing thing when you like, the things posted, they're like, that's not actually like something that applies to me. And that's I think something that we try to carry now as we operate the business.
I am competitive. And as I said, like when I was really young, some of my first meaningful memories are about competition, but fundamentally I am competitive with myself. Right. And sometimes you no doubt go through this in business, right? Like people will be like, oh, such and such entrepreneur is like, you know, whatever, they sold a company for $200 million. Or they did whatever impressive thing. They're like, doesn't that drive you crazy? And I'm like, not really, honestly. Like they're on their journey and I'm on mine.
Yeah.
I'm just here. Like I'm trying to get better. What drives me insane is if I'm not getting better. If H2 is worse than H1, then I'm really pissed, right? Because I'm trying to constantly interrogate what I could do better and improve those things so that I'm on an upward trajectory for myself. But it doesn't bother me if like someone else out there has some like crazily impressive story. I'm like, that's awesome. And you know, maybe one day I'll play on that level. And it's just about like improving my own levels over time.
There's actually this weird complacency when you compare yourself to others. Like, I mean, I got the dog in me. I want to win everything and like be the absolute best. But like, if you actually like look around, you realize one, like I actually think I'm playing on a different game. There's like this like ways that it's a law of averages of this like competitiveness, and the desire to win is not the same as the desire to compare, I think. And like my motivation to beat my coach in every day did not come because someone did that before me. And if that's like how you kind of approach business of like, well, I'm going to do what this person did before me. I think you're probably going to end up pretty average and have average results because you're just like following another blueprint that exists.
So we're talking about this desire to constantly get better, winning, but not comparing. What now as an entrepreneur, what are the things that sort of keep you up at night? Like, what is your sort of central preoccupation these days?
I mean, the number one thing that keeps me up in this time of 2026 is just like pure excitement around what I can do. And we rechanged our entire work structure in April and built a lot of new workflows around AI. And as an idea person, to be able to just, you know, last night it was like, man, I really want to get this one feature done. And I worked till 5 a.m. and it wasn't out of like this, like, holy shit, I'm screwed mentality. It was like, I can't wait to do it. And I feel like I'm a kid. And I think that's like, it's so fun. And I think that's for 2026. I think that's like generally the most of the stuff keeping me up is like, also, I mean, the flip side of that is like, how do you keep up? And I'm an avid person on X and I read everything I possibly can. And like, I use all the tool. I mean, and I still feel like I barely keep up. And so I think that right now is like, how do you make sure that you're giving yourself every edge possible and every tool possible, but also just like get to go do and build the things that you like have been needing and wanting for a long time that can help make the business better. That's by far kind of the main things that I'd say I'm staying up for.
How are you using AI to run the organization differently now from how you might have done it 3 or 4 years ago?
So we were traditional product design engineering. We use an agile system, everything, check, all the things. In April, we flattened it. Internally, we built everybody into two teams. We have our machine team and our builders. There's about 3-to-1 people on machine to builders ratio, a little higher, like 3.2-to-1. The machine team has been building guardrails and workflows, design system, everything that builders and their customer is the builder. So they're not even really, I mean, we have, of course, some folks focused on the architecture of the actual software, but generally what they're doing is building for builders. And our builders are the ones now fully going from design to implementation all the way through QA, and they'll just take a project all the way done. And so we have set projects for the quarter, but we have our objectives. And, you know, as a builder, you have to get done our set projects that are kind of strategic initiatives, but also you have the freedom to just go. If you think, hey, I want to move that dial mile from here to here, and I think this thing's going to help us get a little bit higher, we have a system that basically allows you to map that out, sign it out, build it out, and then push it to production. And we've implemented that in April, and it's been compounding every month with the work of the machine team of like allowing those things to have less bugs, less risk, following best, I mean, all the things. And so, but it's really kind of collapsed our team. No, those roles are kind of gone, but it's allowed us to move significantly faster and pursue what our instincts are more often than just like, oh, here's the like 6 things we're going to do this quarter.
And then how are you seeing that structure in the way you're using AI on the team filter down to the community building, content creation, and marketing work that your customers are sort of doing alongside you?
So, I mean, I just did our all hands today. Our like usage metrics are like all time highs. And then if we look at this week a year ago, it was like top 10 worst weeks of the year. So we're having big success. I think more importantly, we're like, everybody has to have, and I think generally both on the kind of content and community side, as well as on the ad side, is cycles just used to be so slow that customers and users would just, you know, not share feedback. And then if they did share feedback, they never saw it get changed really. And you see some exceptions of this, like Toby on CEO of Shopify, who created a culture around like responding to users. But what we really started with was like, instead of focusing on net new features, like let's just focus on having users and customers feel like we're like not listening to them, but like they wake up the next day and it's done. And can we like create a speed around that? And what we found is that it was an absolute flywheel of feedback, where the more that you did, the faster you did it, the more they gave. And then the more bought in they were, then the more usage they had, and they felt like they were part of the product. And then rewarding them with merch and things like that for just like helping, and just created this like huge cycle. Of course, you always care about your metrics with a feature that you build. But when something takes 8 weeks to build it, you're like, it better fucking work. All right. But now if like someone's just like, hey, tonight, like last night, I was like, hey, I just really want to do this thing. I saw someone submit this for feedback. I want to build it. It takes a day. By next week, I can see how it's working. You're actually more metric forward with the speed than you were when you were more methodical. And I think that also helps really help you focus on prioritization of like what really is going to move the needle or not.
Yeah. So the faster speed of creation and iteration is actually bringing you closer to the customers, which is then creating this sort of like positive feedback loop where you can like keep iterating and get feedback quickly, improve on it, or try something else.
That's not a new theory. I think what's new is that the size of team, the skill sets of team, and who can do that has changed. And so I am not technical by any trade, but I am really close to our customers. And so now I can like leave a meeting and be like, man, I'm going to go like do this because I heard it. And that. I think that just goes a really far way.
So for me, this has been the biggest breakthrough of the last few months with AI is that, you know, I run a service business. We have sort of 15 to 20 clients at any one time. We've passed the point where I can be on every client call, right? But we have, you know, client call transcripts. And like, you can now use AI as a service business CEO to synthesize that information and sort of get closer to your clients, right? And really be up on like what's going on. And you can sort of take the temperature of every account now in a way that was previously impossible. Like a service business owner, even 5 years ago, they need to have account managers, which of course they still do, but they need to rely on the anecdotal account from that person of like what's going on. As we know, as CEOs, right? That's real wishy-washy. And it's good when times are good. And when you have a down quarter, you're like, oh, what the hell is going on? And you don't have insight. And now I have evidence as to what's going on every account. And it's brought me so much closer to my clients, because not only do I know sort of what they're actively concerned about, I can get their own words on and whatever, but it's allowing me to stay in touch with them and sort of send like a customized email or a text and be like, I know what's going on in your business. I know what's going on in the industry because I'm seeing it across all my clients' businesses. And like, here's my take. And that small sort of thing would have been impossible to do even at the scale of 20 clients, you know, 3 years ago.
And the other thing that I have found a good example of that is I really kept asking our sales team, I kept saying like, hey, you know, what are the attributes that customers are asking for? Basically, they're like ICP filtering. So if they want to reach a health system, are they asking about bed counts, facilities, geography? Like what attributes are they asking about? And I'm ready to go build that into the product around the data set. And in general, the sales team is like, they're not really asking about that. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I had a hypothesis that they were just in maybe not an obvious way. Right. So I had to listen to 200 sales calls and it identified like 15 attributes that kept getting brought up. And I think that's the other like opportunity here is like building for the things that people don't know they need. Our sales team wants to meet the customer's needs. I have no doubt that their intention is that they want to do that. Sometimes it's just hard to understand what people want. And I think getting pattern recognition, seeing something across 12 conversations like one time, it's not that different than if you tell a doctor like, hey, I'm tired. And the first time you tell them, they're like, I know, you're fine. Second time, eh, you're fine. Now AI catches it. You said that 12 times in a row, like they're going to realize like, hey, maybe something's wrong. And I think that's this opportunity also to like meet your customers where they're at that like never really existed. I mean, you only got that from your like top people before. And now you can kind of get that across the company all the time.
Right. It can, of course, have to do this difficulty for the CEO to understand what the customer really wants. That could be a consequence of sort of deliberate obfuscation on the result of employees, but that's rarely the case. It's generally just that you're not hearing the client, right? Because it's going through your filter of like, you're looking through whatever you already understand that they want. And like, I know this, you know, because I realized I do it as a salesperson. And I like saw it in myself and in my sales calls before I saw it in my account managers and in client calls, because I would look at, you know, a sales call transcript through AI. And I would be like, I put together this presentation based on the sales call. Like, what do you think? And it would be like, dummy, you miss these like three things they said that seem really important. I'd be like, whoa, so true. I did miss those things. And it's because I had a preconceived notion of what the client's problem was and what they wanted. And when they told me something different, my brain was naturally like almost ignoring it and like slotting it into my preconceived notions of what would work. So people generally talk about AI in terms of creation, right? Creating products, creating content, whatever. But this process of sort of like discerning what people want and getting to the truth and getting evidence, it's so valuable.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, this is like what I worked at a Fortune 500 company for a little while. Like that's, we had product marketers and product researchers. I mean, this is what they would do for a living and they were really good at it and it would cost a fortune and it was slow and all the things. And now you just, you know, I think this is like the, and it relates to ad tech to sales. Like I think today, the more integrated you can be within someone's workflow to get those insights than having them do something extra, the better that is going to be. And that's the, it used to always be like, oh, well, can we do like a special call? Can we do this thing? Can you fill out this survey? It's like, can I get all that from one call? Can I get that from the first discovery call? And all of a sudden you've not only made your client spend less time with you, which is generally something that they want to do, you're also making sure that that one call is like really, really great. And it's easier to train people to do great on one call than train them to be good on five things.
Yeah, 100%. All right, let's get into some of the B2B marketing stuff. Let's get into our core shtick now, Adam. So
here we go.
What? One of the things I see you saying all the time that's very relevant to my business, and I also repeat constantly, is that you don't need to be like a ham to be like sort of a public face and share your expertise on social and boost sort of your own reputation and that of your company. Like I've read all your tweets on this and I totally agree with them. I'm curious for you to talk more as the like owner of this company that sort of depends on B2B creators and on getting like normal professionals who know a lot to share their ideas in public. I'm curious for your experience of why don't people do that and how have you succeeded at getting them to overcome that aversion?
There's the name I have for it's called the experience paradox. And the more experience you have, the more people want to know from you, but the less you're likely to share. And that's how we get LinkedIn. The cause for that, though, I think is like quite simple. It's three things. It's the first one, which I think is like kind of the most BS, but if you talk to people, this is what comes up the most, which is time, I have two kids under four. I run a company. It's hard. It's a lot of time. Time is hard to find the more experience you tend to have. And so is it a real problem? Yes. Is it why you don't do it? No. But it comes up. The second one I think is way more valid and something that we talk a lot about, which is like the risk reward. Hey, I don't want to tweet something and then hear about it the next day from HR or from my team of being like, wait, you said that thing. Like, what's that mean for us? And there's like this, like, I already have 100 headaches. Why would I want to create a possible another one? And the answer to that is the rewards. And I think there's just generally not enough awareness and truthfully reward at times around what can happen when you put yourself out there enough. And it's financial, sure, but it's way more than that. It's, I like to say it's like your career insurance. You are forever and known now as like somebody that has this thing. And like, if that company like doesn't work out, or if this thing happens or that, you like always have that reputation there. And I think what I found in these conversations so much, and my favorite type of people to like have conversation with, I'm like, if I would call your like two closest coworkers, would they just like rave about you? They would. They think you're amazing. You like show up every day. You do a great job. Like those two people would always recommend you for another job. Why not get like 2,000 people like that? And the only difference is that you're just not sharing what you know. And that's like conquering this risk reward basis, I think really helps people honestly normally get over the timing too. Is like, hey, wife, spouse, husband, I can now, this is why I'm doing this. It's going to take up my Sundays. I'm going to do this thing, but it's like worth it. And then lastly, and you were like the only person, no one ever responds to tweets about this except you, which I very much appreciate. No one wants to admit it, but it's insecurity. Mm-hmm. And like these folks lead businesses, they lead teams, they show up every day incredibly confident in themselves. But like I used to do some theater, and like it always amazed me to watch people who would like be in plays and be in a great role and show up in this huge way. And you meet them and they were just like kind of timid and quiet. And it's because like when they were on stage, they had this ability to get this confidence. And so many people in business and that are really great have that same thing. Like when they show up for the presentation, they know how to turn it on and do this. And that confidence, all of a sudden, when you get on social, it just like all goes away. And like they get in their own head and this insecurity of people don't want to hear this. They already know this. I don't know what I have to say is not important. And like rarely do they want to admit that, but that's most of the time the problem. And honestly, the solution to that is just telling them that to their face and being like, I know this is why. It's okay. Let's just like do it. And then they normally get over it.
It's funny because I totally agree that that is the number one reason is just that people are, they're insecure and there's a certain vulnerability to sharing your thoughts publicly. You know, people are afraid that someone's going to be, they're either going to disagree with them and it's going to be a sort of unpleasant disagreement, or people are just going to be like, that's boring, or they're going to get 3 likes. Like, dude, we publish content on the internet about B2B marketing. A lot of our posts get 3 likes, you know, and that's just the reality. Like you need to, again, it's like what you said about going back to like, you know, your early experiences in life of like failing and being comfortable with that and just being like, okay, here's my baseline. How do I get better? Like if you produce a lot of content, you get used to like exercising the muscle of sharing your thoughts publicly, you're going to flop a lot. You're going to have a lot of posts that no one cares about. And it's like, it's totally fine because guess what? If no one like interacted with it, then either A, actually 10 people did interact with it. And especially in B2B, they may be the right people, right? Which is another thing we both preach is quality over quantity. And B, if truly no one interacted with it, then it just goes into the ether and it's fine.
So that point, we built an entire kind of slogan, company, the product, everything that we do integrates this philosophy around who, not how many. So like any of our ad reporting, any of our content, any of our metrics we show internally, externally to anybody, it is like absolutely real that like there are 200 health systems. If I had the CEOs of all those on my newsletters, you literally have trillions of dollars of budget at your disposal. Why the hell would I care about anyone else? And like also this like gamification, clickbait, whatever, other ways to like get how many, and it actually means no influence at all, and actually and sometimes negative. And I think the other aspect though, besides even if it gets 3 likes, and I see this more times than I can tell you, is people go back and read that. It's a resume. And like when I was fundraising, people bring it up. Like I walked into a meeting with like a really big firm and he said this line to me and he's like, oh, how about that leaky bucket problem of newsletters? And I was like, I wrote that newsletter 2 years ago. Like, and he knew, he went back and read it. And he loved it. He was like, yeah, I like couldn't agree more. I hadn't named it yet. Like, I get it. It is like you actively building your thoughts and resumes. And guess what? Like over time, it's okay if it changes. It's okay if it's wrong. People do dumb stuff when they're 20. People do dumb stuff when they're 30. They say stupid things. It's okay. And like, I think that's, you just have to kind of accept that and move on.
I did this super, human sort of honest post recently about failure because I had been fired a couple of times in the past month. And I wanted to, you know, share what I was going through and sort of how I think about it as an entrepreneur. And it got like, you know, 25 reactions on LinkedIn, but like 12, like 15 of them were from like CEOs in my industry, right? And it's like, why is it resonating with those people? It's like, because CEOs and founders are the people who like chew the glass, right? They are the people who like constantly fail, and they fail in front of other people, and like it's painful, and you know, they keep going. And so it's like, I don't know, I've been thinking a lot more about this recently, especially with like the proliferating AI slop on like especially LinkedIn. Like I just think there is such a premium, and again, especially in B2B, on these human connections. And like most of us in B2B, whether we're salespeople, marketers, CEOs, it's like we're trying to reach like under 100 people, right? Who are just like, and we're just trying to create a human connection with those like 20, 50, 100 people. And if you can do a post that gets 3 of those 100 people on a given morning to like remember you exist and be like, I F with that guy, then like that's really good, you know? And you need
to think
in terms of the real impact.
And like the hard part is like when you're, let's call it like when you're a finance person, you're not like thinking about like, wow, Twitter's incentives as a horizontal platform really don't align to me understanding the who I'm trying to reach, right? Like, you're looking at like, oh, I get 3 likes and this meme gets 1 million. I think in many ways, you know, and this is very much work week related, but I think like the horizontal platforms don't reward that behavior enough. And it does just naturally after, you have to just be like ruthless in your own intrinsic motivation and not externally to be like, I'm just going to keep posting. I'm going to keep posting. I'm going to keep posting. But yeah, I can without a doubt say that every major introduction of any investor I've ever worked with came from Twitter. And I average like 12 likes per post, right? So like it's a false signal in so many ways. And I think also like you have to recognize one of our values at Workweek when we create content is like avoid the lowest common denominator. And the reason for that is like, it's so easy to think that smart people don't think you're smart because you have low likes, but that's like such a lowest common denominator thinking. Like smart people know.
Oh, I love that.
Smart people know like, oh shit, that's a smart post. And it doesn't matter how many likes you have, and you just have to like avoid that.
Right. And the who can work in the wrong direction too, right? Like on LinkedIn in particular, there are a lot of B2B marketers who just create content for other marketers. And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but it all depends on what you're trying to achieve, right? If you're like me, right, and you're running like a B2B marketing agency, you actually really want to be talking to a combination of CEOs of those companies are honestly probably your primary target. And then secondarily, marketing. Like if you're the marketer who's doing a lot of content, just like complaining about like CEOs or your clients or like something like that, it'll do better quality, right? It'll drive more likes, but it's not actually going to drive business outcomes. So sometimes the quality actually is in contrast or in tension with the quantity.
One of the things that we do to help people create content is that we make you build out personas of who you're writing for early. And that's natural to marketers to hear that. Mm-hmm. But like if you're an HR, that's not like something you're told, or if you're running a hospital, like it's just not a thing that you know, but it's a big difference. You know, for me, I try to do a portion of content for potential creators, a portion of content for B2B advertisers, and a portion of content for like entrepreneur or investors. But like that has to be very intentional then how you build that out a little bit and think about it. But I think too many people kind of walk in and don't have a strategy around that. And it doesn't need to be like wildly a ton of work, but like when you don't think about it, all of a sudden you're chasing the wrong things and getting the wrong reward mechanisms.
So we're preaching to the choir here, talking about quality over quantity and all these other precepts. But when you're not preaching to the choir, when you're preaching to like the CFO or something like that, or you're helping your CMO clients speak to their CFO, what sort of work have you done or metrics have you come up with or frameworks to help Workweek's advertisers understand the value of these like very targeted audiences? You mentioned, for example, reporting on who, not how many. So tell us more about that.
So it's our goal to have the most transparent and highest performing B2B ad network. And the transparency part is the hard part there. Performance comes from having great creators and having great audiences that trust you. And I have to enable that to happen, which we've spent the last 3 or 4 years building out. But transparency means not falling into the trap of lying, exaggerating, whatever you want to call it. And so like, you know, something we've done, like two things particularly for advertisers. One, we're mostly email and newsletter based, and really one of the only B2B ad networks on that is more native newsletter. And one of the issues that I've learned through the years of working at The Hustle and all these newsletter companies is that open rates have just continued to be a lie. That like the non-human interactions basically have continued to go up as security scanners have gone up, particularly in B2B. And the problem is none of the email platforms, you name them, they all do the same thing. None of them want to admit that it's all fake because then their competitors blame them for bad deliverability. And so if they lower their open rates, be honest, their competitor says, look, see, your open rates are worse there, come here. And so it's allowed all of a sudden, like 10 years ago, a really, really good unique open rate was like 27-28%. And now like it's 50. And I'm like, this is that, like, sorry, it's not happening. And so what we did, we made our own model. We open sourced it on GitHub and we really filtered out all the next level of security scanners and interactions and obvious things like, hey, this person did not click 10 links in 4 seconds. Like that just didn't happen. And it lowered our open rates by half. Mm-hmm. And I could look at all my advertising and be like, I'm telling the truth. So this is who actually opened it. And then clicks is even more. It's like 98% of all clicks and emails now are not human interactions. And I was like, now we're doing with clicks. But what you can trust is that unit is correct. And what we've done is through building our identity graph, we're able to take that engagement and put it into their CRM. And the reason why no other email ad network can do that is because those metrics are a lie for them. So then they'd be putting their very not correct metrics into a CRM that a salesperson would believe is true. And then that person's going to call them and be like, did you just engage with this ad? And the person will be like, I have no effing clue what you're talking about. And it's a bad look for everybody. And so I think it's a first principle thinking of like telling a truth and what it enables downstream. But you had to have the hard conversation and be like, guess what? No one's telling the truth here. And that who though carries, if you can meet someone in their CRM of where it is and it's a match. Now, do you really care what the CTR is if you had 10 of your top 100 customers engaged with that ad? I don't think so. And so that's, it's kind of flipping the whole model on its head is what we've done.
We've kind of come full circle because again, it's like about that failure and that honesty, right? Like you're saying to the Workweek advertisers what your tutor said to you about Spanish class, right? You're like, look, we don't have a 50% open rate. We're not driving 10 clicks in 4 seconds. Here's where we're at, right? Like here's whom you're actually able to reach. If you think about it for 2 seconds, actually that is immensely valuable. And so let's work with that honest baseline and do better. I think what you've arrived at is sort of this really differentiated position within B2B advertising, which is like telling the truth. And that's a pretty cool business model.
It's what we try to do. Every salesperson I hire, we've been able to kind of bring on some amazing sales leaders from all across the kind of B2B ad sales landscape. And I write a weekly newsletter. And last week, we have Upfronts, which is an event in a couple of weeks. And we bring in all of our customers to Austin and have a good time and talk about our big launches coming up. And I emailed out, I do a weekly newsletter internally, and I emailed out and I said, hey, you know, the theme of this year is like transparency and honesty, and like why it matters. And tell me something in your past career where everyone knew it was a lie, but no one said it out loud, but like you knew it. And I mean, everyone ever thought it was of the B2B ad sales team. They're like, everywhere I worked, it was a lead gen program that we just bought those leads and sold them from somewhere else. So like, it was just, yeah. I've been in that game and it doesn't last. And the clock will hit sooner or later. And more importantly, I think we have the creators and the content that actually perform. And if you can prove performance, you can pay, get more money. If you can get more money, you can pay, make people have a better reward to risk system and hopefully get more people to create content. So that's kind of what we're focused on.
Yeah, 100%. And generally, the problem is when people hear prove performance, right, they rush to all the normal BS tactics and you're taking a different path to that. And it's very cool to see. So Adam, thank you so much for doing this. Great to talk with you. And yeah, good luck with everything you're doing. And we can keep liking each other's posts so we can get past 3 likes one day.
You got a friend in me, my friend. It's all good. And it's okay. I'll take 3 if it continues to give me good podcasts with the right people. So thanks, Joe, for having me on. And I can't wait to listen to the next one.
Thank you very much.